Well, the holiday season is upon us once again, and that means spending time with family. Here with his advice on how to manage the holidays, please welcome Drunk Uncle.
It is great to be here hosting Saturday Night Fever.
Okay. So, Drunk Uncle, are you excited for the holidays?
The holidays are not what they used to be, Seth. You know, when I was a kid, you know, Christmas meant something. You know, people got dressed up. You know, they would travel 6 hours in a car. Nowadays, it's just, hey, could you email me dinner? Hey, could you fax me a hug?
It's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays.
You know what I like about Christmas, though? That sexy green M&M lady. I would have hit that. Come on. You thought about it.
No, I really haven't.
You thought about it. Every kiss begins with K. Put that on your iPad and smoke it.
Okay, this question made me laugh, and I don't want to laugh at the guy. So I don't know if it's a genuine question or if he's just trying to be funny or what, because it's just sort of like, I imagine these are the kind of questions you get on occasion at conferences and when you run into folks who are fans. He says, please ask Stanton, Jim Sapp is the man. He says, please ask Stanton what he thinks the hybrids will end up doing with mankind.
I avoid making any predictions like that. I don't know, and I'm not a soothsayer. I'm a nuclear physicist, and they're different. Sometimes you have to make predictions about what's going to happen when you're doing an experiment, or you wouldn't do it in the first place, or you'd have some notion of what you're looking for. But I have no idea what they're doing. Well, we can observe what they've done in a loose sense, but we don't get all the data. The government knows all kinds of stuff that it's not telling us. Although maybe that day is changing after this weekend. I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the reason I laugh is just because it's like the question begins from such a point of assumption where it's what do you think the hybrids will end up? We don't know if there are hybrids, man. We don't know. You know, that's.
I haven't talked to any.
Yeah. Chris Hobbs says, coming from New Zealand, so we've got a listener here from New Zealand with a question, I've always been fascinated by the Kaikoura lights. He says, as a 7-year-old kid at the time, it freaked me out. He's wondering what you think of it, as it was a big thing back then, but somewhat unknown outside of New Zealand. I've never heard of this. Have you heard of this Kaikoura light?
Oh yes, okay. Yes. And Dr. Bruce Maccabee, who is one of the outstanding ufologists around, he's got a PhD in optical physics, worked for a Navy research lab for 30 years, outstanding scientist. He's written a couple of books. Bruce went down to Kaikoura. I'd forgotten the name, but there were some very good radar visual sightings, and he went to explore those and found out more information, so I was very impressed with his findings. Yes, something really happened there, and yes, it does seem to have involved extraterrestrial spacecraft. If they're not from here, they're from someplace else. That, you know, that doesn't say I know what their home address is.
Right, right. Okay, now this actually, in a good way, kind of ties in, too, to the Times piece, because I forgot about this hot take that I saw. So this was actually submitted before the article, but we'll connect it in a sense. Kirk Walker, he wants to know if you believe the claims of a secret space program complete with bases on Mars, and why or why not do you think that? It's kind of the same.
No. As a matter of fact, last year's MUFON conference, Mutual UFO Network Symposium in Vegas, which I did not attend, but I did read all the papers. So when you give a paper at a MUFON annual symposium, you have to provide a written copy, and it's published in the proceedings, a couple hundred pages usually. And I've spoken at more of these than anybody else, I guess, that was true up until a couple of years ago anyway. Anyway, I read the secret space program one, and I was very disappointed because it was long on claims and short on evidence. So I'm not saying I can prove there hasn't been one, but I've seen no evidence that there was. In other words, where we have gone off to Mars and other places. Some people are even claiming that President Obama was one of the people who spent time on Mars.
Oh, yeah, yeah, crazy stuff, yeah.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff like that. Now, I'm not saying I can prove it didn't happen, because I haven't made the effort to account for Obama's presence, you know, every week. But I'm saying I haven't seen evidence, and I was disappointed. Corey Good is one name that comes to mind just because it's a little unusual. But so I'm not satisfied that we have traipsed off to other planets. I'm not saying we can't keep secrets, but I'm saying I haven't seen any evidence. And evidence is the key word. There are all kinds of possibilities. Which one? You better give me evidence before you pick one.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're also, in a sense, needs to, there's almost like a delineation in a sense too, I think, because like a lot of these quote-unquote whistleblowers, they paint this picture of like a sophisticated secret space program when it very well, when we should probably assume there is kind of like a secret space program of like secret, you know, tests of craft and whatnot, but it may be not like fully furnished bases on Mars and stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's expensive, incidentally.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, the reason why I mentioned it kind of connects in a sense to the times, because that's the argument I've also heard, that it's like that these people that it's like confusion in a sense, where people, one hand doesn't know what the other's doing, compartmentalized secrets, where it's like the UFOs they see are secret craft, they're secret American craft, but they don't know it, so they have to. So does that make any? You understand kind of the scenario,
yes,
I'm painting
and,
here?
And I don't believe that notion for a minute. If we had the advanced technology, we'd be using it, we'd be showing it, we'd be threatening the world. Don't come bothering us, because we're ready for you, buddy, because look what we got that you don't know about. It's part of the dynamics between countries, which is a very complicated kind of business.
Right. Well, it's funny, too, in a sense, where you like look at, the Robert Hastings, Robert Salas sort of research, and it's like, well, if we had the technology to fly over a nuclear base and disarm their missiles, like, I think they'd be seeing a lot of UFOs in North Korea right about now.
I suppose so.
You know,
maybe they are.
I guess.
Nobody's telling us.
That's true. I don't watch a lot of North Korean propaganda television. That's true. But, you know, so we'll see. We'll see. Okay, now we got a really cool question here from no less than legendary parapolitical conspiracy writer Ken Thomas, who's participating in the listener question portion of the holiday special. He wants to know, he would like to hear your thoughts, nuclear scientist Stan, address the role of ufological history played by scientists of dissenting and controversial views like Tesla and Wilhelm Reich.
Well, I think there's no question that if you follow the progress chart of science for, say, the last 140 years, I think you'll find that many of them were not taken seriously without all kinds of effort being made to put out the evidence. They had to work extra hard to defend their position, whereas the critics didn't. They could just do their criticism by claim. The top American astronomer, Dr. Simon Newcomb, in 1902, October, stated in print that if there was one thing he was sure of, man would never fly any distance in an enclosed vehicle, maybe in a balloon. And that was 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight.
Yeah.
So, and that means that kind of attitude made it very hard for the Wright brothers and others to get financial support, because the big wheels were saying there's nothing to this. The same thing happened in 1956. The British Astronomer Royal said, he was asked by a Time magazine reporter, and it's in Time magazine, what about space travel? And he said, utter bilge. There's nothing to it. Who would pay for it? What good would it do? What we need is better equipment for astronomy. This is a year before Sputnik went up. And the field that got the most benefit from the space program was astronomy. because suddenly they could make measurements, you know, from above the atmosphere and so forth. But it wasn't because they pushed for space travel.
Yeah.
They wanted equipment they could put in space, but somebody else is going to pay for it because, you know, what good would it do? What can I say? Strange history is loaded with nasty, noisy negativists, naysaying newsmen, fossilized physicists.
Yeah.
You could put together, people have, well, science was wrong. In the book that Kathleen Martin and I published, one of ours, 14 chapters, each one stimulated by some very smart person saying something very stupid.
Yeah.
Like, you can't fly, et cetera, et cetera. So the history of science is loaded with claims that this is impossible, that's impossible. As a matter of fact, the original title for that book was going to be It's Impossible, Isn't It?
There's
a long history there.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's funny. You don't see Tesla attached to ufology very much. But
Tesla certainly was a great scientist who had more patents than you can shake a stick at, you know, comparable to Edison. And he had a hard time all the time from people. He was saying things which they thought were impossible.
Yeah. And Wilhelm Reich's another guy that's sort of like, you know, erased in a sense from this sort of history of this stuff.
And the kicker is that there are some people who are open to the new, looking forward instead of looking backward. Because something was impossible 20 years ago doesn't mean it's impossible now, or because you can't do it using technique A doesn't mean there isn't a technique B and C out there.
Right, right.
The history of science is loaded with examples of that. And that's why I mentioned the book, because we have loads of foolish pronouncements from people who should have known better.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, I think back to an interview I did with the guy who he wrote a book on the boy who invented television, and Philo Farnsworth, and it was like he came up with the idea for mowing his field, and it was like if he had gone to school and everything, like he never would have come up with the idea because he would have been told that things didn't work that way.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
We need more people like that.
There are loads of them out there.
Mm. And then another former BOA audio guest, a beloved BOA audio guest, the wild and woolly William Zabel, he has a question. He wants to know if you can address the position that some in the field hold about UFOs being interdimensional. I feel like we've covered this many times in the past, but it's a continuing question. So
my normal reaction to that is that's an easy way out for people who've read a lot of science fiction. We don't know any way that they could do these things, so let's come up with something that we don't know how to do, like interdimensional. But you don't need – that's where my background in technology puts me in a better position than most to judge this sort of thing. The biggest reason that we're dealing with this is with interstellar travel. And I worked on a study of nuclear fusion for deep space travel in 1962, for God's sakes. I worked on a fission nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system, which we operated at Westinghouse Astronuclear. The test was done at the nuclear test site in Nevada, but less than 8 feet in diameter, power level, 1,000 megawatts. Now, Hoover Dam produces 2,000 megawatts. It's a little larger than 8 feet in diameter.
Yeah.
And the test was very successful. The exhaust temperature, and I'm sure many people would have said this is impossible, it was 4,000 degrees. Liquid hydrogen goes in at close to absolute zero and goes out at 4,000 degrees. It's a marvel of engineering. And I'll admit, when we ran the first test, we didn't know how long the thing would stick together, the filament's going to come out, you know. And I was listening to the test back in Pittsburgh when the test was being run out west. And 5 minutes nominal temperature and pressure, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and we're looking at each other. Holy cow. Well, the maximum time you could operate the system was an hour because you could only store so much liquid hydrogen out there. And we made it the full hour. There was such delight. And I was especially pleased because I had been asked like 2 weeks before, Stan, we're not sure what the heating rate is in the control vanes outside the reactor. doctor. Could you come up with some data for us in the next 2 weeks before we run the test? So I had to design some experiments and make some measurements and so forth, and I concluded that indeed we were okay. We were not going to melt the fuel of the control elements, which would have been fatal, to tell you the truth. And so I realized as this test was going on, if this thing fails, they may blame me for that. So I was especially pleased that the test went off successfully.
Yeah. So essentially you're saying, like I said, we've covered this one a bunch of times in the past. The interdimensional thing, you think it's just sort of like, it's sort of, I don't know, a red herring in a sense, of sorts.
Yes. Okay. I'm not saying we won't learn how to do that at some point in time, but it isn't necessary to invoke magic, which is basically what that is. Magic,
exactly,
meaning,
yeah,
it's something we don't know how to do, but it's incredible. You know, that's nice. I don't know how aliens go through walls without making holes in the walls, you know?
Yeah.
And things like that. And how can they operate without making any noise? That's pretty intriguing. Well, it means they're not doing things the way we're doing, you know.
There you go. Okay, Sean Knight. He wants to know if there's any classic UFO case or cases that has a big reputation in ufology, but that you think is actually explainable as something prosaic or a hoax.
Not that I can think of offhand, because I try to free my mind of the hoaxes and the prosaics and all this kind of stuff. Because remember, the question isn't, are all UFOs alien spacecraft? The question is, are any? So do I need to explain them all? No.
You just need to find the one.
Yeah, that'll do it. How many isotopes are fashionable? Well, there's U-235 and U-235. You know, the fact that most aren't is beside the point.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that kind of makes sense in a way, because that's a tough question, because I looked at that question and was thinking about what it's hard to come up with. Like, it's like, say, It's not even like what's your favorite bad movie, in a sense. You know what I mean? It's like, because once I hear a story that's bogus, I just generally forget about it. You know what I mean? So it's...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Marty Littlejohn, he wants to know if you think we have the technology to get back to the moon, and he says it's kind of a gray area at the moment, or have we been warned off? I think he's like...
The question is whether we have the money and the will, not whether we have the technology. And even like going to Mars, the nuclear rocket engine that I mentioned, which was successfully tested, three different ones were tested in 68, 69, 70 by Westinghouse Astor Nuclear Aerojet and Los Alamos. I'm not making this stuff up. A nuclear rocket engine could double or triple a payload to Mars. Now, the question whether we use one or not is a political question. You know, do we dare to risk it, kind of thing? And I, for listeners, we're not talking about the nuclear rocket engine as the lift vehicle. We're talking about it as the top stage.
Yeah.
Safety problems. If when you're near the ground, you just as soon not have something explode on the pad, kind of thing.
Right.
If it explodes up there, no big deal. Expensive, but no big deal.
We hope. That might be what the aliens have been trying to stop us from doing. To jump in on this question in a sense, because he sort of had this as a dangling part at the end, it's like a whole different question in a sense. He wants to know, you know, he's asked about the technology to get to the moon. Do you think we have been warned off of it? What do you think of the theory that you know, they went to the moon and they were like, they told us not to come back, they being the aliens?
Well, I have suggested that. People have said, why didn't we go back to the moon? And, you know, Apollo 18 was built in 19. We didn't use them. And I have suggested maybe the aliens told us to stay the heck off our planet.
Yeah.
And so I allow room for that. I don't know. I don't sit at the meetings where the big shots decide what's going on. And that's a reasonable there's another possibility, of course, obviously, even if they didn't tell us not to come back. If we know that there's stuff up there that would prove to anybody who saw it that there are aliens out there, the government isn't ready until this past weekend to say aliens are visiting here.
Yeah.
So if we were to say, you know, back a little while ago, you know, 2 weeks ago, if we were to say that they're coming here, somebody might give us a hard time.
Right, right. Well, yeah. I mean, to be fair, we still haven't. We're still only one step of the way here to the big D disclosure, but it's, you know.
Well, sure, but you know, again, I mentioned we're talking all kinds of big programs for the government.
Yeah.
I mentioned $100 million a year for nuclear airplanes in 1958. At GE, we had 3,400 employees, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. We're not talking about a small program. We're talking about a huge program. The existence of the program wasn't classified. The data was.
Right, exactly, yeah.
We learned a lot of stuff, but the program was canceled. We didn't operate a nuclear-powered airplane. We know how to do it. If you wanted to spend the dough, you could go. But, you know, that's a different question.
Right, right, exactly. Okay. Red pill junkie or well, actually, hold on now. T. Erickson essentially sent the same question in as Marty Littlejohn's. Interesting, sort of, and on different mediums. So it's like interesting that was in people's minds. Let me just see if there's anything in this question that we didn't cover sort of in that line of thought. He says, if the government has reverse-engineered alien spacecraft, why is it still so tough to get above low Earth orbit and go back to the moon or Mars? I guess his question, to be fair, is such a complex thing. His question is not, did we get warned away or do we not have the technology to do it again, but how come we don't have the technology from crashed UFOs if that really happened?
Well, certainly there have been crashed UFOs, not only at Roswell and the plains of San Augustine and Aztec and a few other places. Knowing how something works doesn't allow you to build it. That takes money and technology and all kinds of things. You know, if I hand the smartest people on the planet a solid-state device in 1934, you know, a little radio, could they have built it? Not a chance. We didn't know anything about small electronics.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like nuclear weapons. Well, do you know how much dough we spent getting to be able to make nuclear weapons? Well, our first isotope separation plant was a mile long, uranium isotopes in gaseous form being pumped in at one end. And because U-235 is a little lighter than U-238, it moves a little faster, and pretty soon you enrich it. We were using 5% of all the power being produced in the United States during the war, this is.
Yeah.
To separate uranium isotopes. We're talking a lot of dough, and there were an awful lot of people working on that program in secret. So, you know, knowing something can be done doesn't tell you how to do it, and knowing how to do it doesn't get it built until you spend the money and the effort. You got to do all kinds of new stuff, working with weird materials. Look, on my first job, working with things like beryllium, beryllium oxide, lithium hydride, tungsten alloys. Who ever heard of this stuff? They're real.
Yeah.
They're real. And they're not easy to make, incidentally. And some of them are dangerous, too, for that matter. So there are all kinds of questions that need answering that means a lot of time, money, effort, and caution.
Yeah.
Making sure you don't have accidents when people get killed and stuff like that.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of time, so we'll see if that if we're gonna see any fruits of that money and effort that maybe was kept under wraps. Miguel Romero, who writes under the pen name Red Pill Junkie, he's super popular online, emerging writer and thinker in this field. He has a pretty deep question for you, so I'm going to dive into this one, and then I'll tell you when to fire away. He says, you recently said to Alex Sakiris that aliens probably know a whole lot more than we do about telepathy and NDEs, yet you still seem to cling to the notion that the ETH is the likeliest explanation to the UFO mystery and that these ETs are coming here using structured metal craft. Isn't that just akin to dipping your toes in the consciousness pond instead of fully sinking in? If telepathy is real, as Joshua Cutchin pointed out in his essay for UFOs Reframing the Debate, then that means consciousness is non-local. And if that is the case, then why would aliens need structured metal craft to visit us when they could just project themselves non-corporeally the same way remote viewers like Ingo Swan allegedly do? So that's the question.
Well, if you're going to take samples back, you better have a vehicle to do it with, is one answer, obviously. The fact, I would be astonished if advanced civilizations, such as those visiting the planet, haven't learned a great deal about telepathy and all the other sort of oddball, but I think quite real phenomena that go on. Reincarnation. I think the aliens know about reincarnation. And how the heck do they get through walls and all that sort of stuff? How do they move people? You know, so I think it's part of the armament. It's not the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, like I say, if you're here to mine, Earth is the densest planet, heavy metals, osmium, rhenium, platinum, good stuff like that. It takes real vehicles and real energy supplies. That doesn't mean that the same guys don't know how to read minds and project their thoughts and do all kinds of other great stuff. They're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. All right. Well, I like your I think in a sense too. I liked your answer there about getting back samples because I never even considered that as the answer to Miguel's question, but it makes perfect sense. And I guess what I think in a sense when I hear the question is, projecting your consciousness might actually just be really hard to do. Like maybe it's not sustainable. So who knows? You know, just because, I mean, we
maybe
can't
that
do it.
Doesn't keep the guy from pulling the trigger on a gun he's aiming at you. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe their whole thing is to interact in a way that we can't. That requires an actual physical presence. And also, I think in a way, I think there may be a chance that we're going to find out eventually that there's a large contingent of like robots involved in this. Where it's like,
could be, why not?
Because, you know, a lot of times there's questions about the occupants of these craft, like how could they survive this and that and the other thing, and it's like, maybe just because we're seeing how the robots are developing here, so it's like, if they're that advanced,
yeah.
You know.
Well, let me give you an example of something. People are frequently misrepresented the facts about how much acceleration we can stand. Oh, you'd be torn to bits or compressed and this, that, and the other thing. There is data on this kind of stuff. A person, for example, can actually stand 30 Gs for 1 second, believe it or not. That's 0 to 600 miles an hour in 1 second. I'm not saying I'm volunteering for the trip. And there are all kinds of data on pilots. There was a guy who calculated about interstellar about going to the moon. An astronomer in the 40s who assumed that you'd be limited to 1G acceleration. Well, 5 is routine for astronauts. Now, you're not walking around drinking a beer while this is going on, okay. But when you've got airplanes being flown by people, the plane and the person have restrictions on what kind of acceleration they can stand. You design within those parameters. We're talking engineering, not thought experiments. And we can find out how much acceleration people can stand and in what direction it should be applied. You may notice that the astronauts go up on their backs,
yeah,
not on their feet, because you can stand a heck of a lot more force back to front than foot to head.
Yeah,
that's the way it is. And so you're not doing this in a vacuum. Well, you do fly in a vacuum.
Right. Oh, that's true. Yeah. All right. I think we covered that question. I feel bad in a sense because, like, it's a very complicated question, but I think your take is that, like, that you're not discounting the possibility that the aliens can do all sorts of things. You know, that it's just not
–
they're not just limited to just flying here in metal craft. You know,
it's a good way to stave off the some of the radiation in space too, incidentally. And you do have to have some way of being able to breathe, which means you got to watch about the vacuum and so forth. There are some limitations on people as passengers or pilots.
Right, right. And I think part of the thing, too, is, like, that we sort of have to work with the tools that we have, in a sense, even intellectually, where it's like, yeah. we've seen us fly our species to another thing, so it's like, that seems, we don't necessarily, although there are some compelling stories, we don't necessarily know that, like, you can project your consciousness to other places, so it's like, we have to work with what, that's why that seems to be the predominant thing, because that's the only way we know necessarily how this might be pulled off.
Yeah, I'm not saying there aren't other ways of doing it, but I want to protest loudly against anybody who says there is no technology that will allow us to do A, B, C, or D when they haven't looked at the technology.
Right. Okay. Corey Thornton writes, please ask Stanton to dig deep into his gray basket, which I still hope you'll write a book, Stanton Friedman's Gray Basket. Maybe this will be the spark that lights the fire. Dig into your gray basket for the strangest case of a UFO sighting encounter that you ever came across in your research. Was there anything that felt so far outside of the normal telltale signs of variables that you just found yourself completely stumped yet fascinated? He says, thank you, my best wishes for the season to both you, and my thanks to you for the work that you've done in bringing and digging deeper into the paranormal and esoteric. Sorry, I botched the end there, but I think you
thanks.
Got the question.
I don't know how to rate strangest case because it is based on the behavior. The Betty and Barney Hill case, I find a fascinating case because they were able to control their behavior, which was very important, so that Betty and Barney could not keep them from doing what they wanted to do. They were being specimens, you know, catch and release program.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of special effort, would for us, to make sure that people don't behave in the ways we don't want them to behave if we want to grab them and examine them and toss them back. The aliens seem to be able to do a lot of things that we don't know how to do. One of them is to control the thinking and therefore behavior of Earthlings when they take them on board. And that's kind of far out, but that's the way it seems to be.
Yeah.
So be it.
Okay, now Chris Hadley, he wrote in essentially with the same question that we got earlier about secret space program. Again, it's interesting. You know, we get these questions, and they're eerily similar, and these guys didn't know the other ones sent them in.
Sure.
So he's interested in the secret space program. I pretty much think we answered the question. I guess he wants to know, are such individuals being allowed to speak about such experiences because the powers that be feel that the media and others won't believe them, or do you feel that there may be some level of truth in what they are claiming? He gives two options there, but there are many others in the middle.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly aspects of the space program that are secret details. But I don't think, in the sense in which the term is used, that is, we're flying vehicles to the moon or other places, maybe Mars and so forth. I have seen no evidence, if you will, that there is such a program involving lots of people, lots of equipment, major effort, that we're doing stuff in secret. Yes, of course. You always want to do things that the other guy doesn't know about and not tell him. You don't want him to learn from you. You want to learn from him. What has he done that he doesn't know you know about what he has done? So there are all these games that are played all the time. There's more than one space-faring society on this planet. You may have noticed. I forget how many people have put up satellites, but it's a lot. You know?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, like I said, we covered that before, so it's interesting. This secret space program, it's big in the it's in the UFO zeitgeist now, so it's interesting.
Yes.
Jim Vujovic, he wonders what you know or think about the electric universe theory, the idea that it's electromagnetism that drives the universe, not gravity, and the sun is not a big ball of nuclear fusion but instead a big ball of burning plasma.
Well, those two aren't exclusive. If you got nuclear fusion, it involves plasmas. I worked on fusion. Fusion is a plasma phenomena. After all, you got to get the various gases to react with each other, and that means not being repelled. You know, positive and negative particles repel each other when they get close. So you got to overcome that repulsion.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's plenty going on there.
All right. And James Leroy Wilson wants to know, what's your favorite space travel movie? Which is good. That's the last question, so it's a good wrap-up.
I don't tend to rank things. I was there in the first showing of Close Encounters, and I enjoyed it, frankly. So I don't have favorites. I look to see if there's good stuff in all of them, and there may be good and bad, and things that you say, oh, no, come on.
Yeah.
You know, so... And half the problems that you have to worry about is people's attitudes, not so much technology.
Yeah.
Is that how they would act or that kind of thing? And one of the things that I find interesting is that the aliens don't seem to make a habit of intentionally inflicting pain or distress on specimens. They pick us up and they put us back.
Right.
But they don't damage us along the way with a willy-nilly approach to who gives a darn about these specimens. They seem to be careful. There seems to be some kind of a rule about how you behave, and that pleases me because one of the things we have a problem with on this planet is we don't follow rules for how to behave toward other people. $1 trillion a year for war... for military tells you that, doesn't it?
Yeah, that makes sense, where it's like you talk about the human species being sort of like this war species, and it's like it makes sense in a way because it's like the aliens can't trust us to abide by the rule that apparently they're using. So it's like maybe that's why we're not welcome into the galactic community, because they don't trust us.
Primitive society's major activity is tribal warfare.
Okay, now I'm loath to do this, but we have a caller, and it is the holiday special. It's the holiday season, so I feel like if I didn't put them on to ask a question, I'd be rude. So
okay.
We'll do that, and then we'll call it a night. So okay. All right, 804 area code. You're on the air. Thanks for calling the holiday special with Stanton Friedman. Do you have a question for Stan?
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. There is a YouTube of Stanton's nephew, Paul Kimball, talking with Greg Bishop about Harry Rozitsky, who was a high-level CIA operative and known supposedly as the Falcon in the aviary. I was wondering if Stanton did know Harry Rozitsky, because they get into the UFO connection, and also his comments on Andrew Basaggio and his teleportation, and Alfred Weber and Laura Magdalene Eisenhower.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, and we'll try and we'll. All right.
Well okay. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on those. I'm not a fan of Basaggio. I read his stuff, and again, the lack of evidence gets to me all the time.
Yeah.
Stories are cheap, easy. Actions are not.
There you go.
Who were the other guys? There were a couple more. There.
Alfred Weber, he's the exopolitics guy.
Yeah, and again, I've looked at his stuff, spent a lot of time reading it and looking at it, and not impressed.
Okay. And who was the last person? Laura Eisenhower, you said?
Yeah,
yes.
I never really dug into Laura Eisenhower. I don't know enough about her to make a sensible judgment based on facts and data, because I don't have the facts and data.
All right. Okay, caller. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a happy holidays. We're trying to do it fast because, you know, Stan's giving us so much time and everything. But thank you, sir, for calling in.
We want to give my address
if
we can.
We're going to do
my
that.
Let's do that.
All right. Well, thank you for the caller. I told you I was a little – that took us down a strange path. So, but we've reached – all right. One guy in the chat room, is there such a thing called gravity waves?
Yes.
Okay.
The guy's just got a Nobel Prize for that.
That's the way we want to wrap up the holiday special. Stan, I can't thank you enough for doing this. And like I said, this isn't the last, you know, because people get nervous and stuff because I'm dropping the weekly format for a while. And it's like I told them, I'm going to keep doing this. This is like my favorite thing in the world to do. This is like –
my favorite night of the year in a lot of ways. It's one of the many nights that I'm filled with joy afterwards, and it's another night like that tonight. So I can't thank you enough for doing this. I love you, man. I consider you a huge mentor, friend. Just you're everything to me, man. You are the best, and I hope you have a happy holidays, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Same to you. Thank you for having me again.
And one last thing, like you said earlier, you said you weren't sure if you deserve to be thanked or whatever. No, man, congratulations, on this news, because, this is the result of a lot of hard work from other people, too, that maybe aren't involved in all this stuff. So I'm glad you sit back and relish in this, man, and enjoy it. So
I did.
All right. Well, happy holidays. Thanks again. And
thank you.
We'll talk to you next season.
Okay. Thanks.
Good night.
Good night.
There you go, folks. That was Stanton Friedman. I meant next holiday season, not BOA Audio season 11. So just hold your horses there. I got to give amazing credit to Stan that every year, no matter how many questions we have, he hits that on the 90-minute mark. He just nails it right on the 90-minute mark. And I think I even ended up throwing a couple curveballs there with the caller and with the gravity waves question at the end. So, yeah, I really had a great time, and I really loved this show. And that was great. And as I said to Stan, it's so rare that we get the chance to talk about some crazy breaking UFO news, because the UFO phenomenon has been so stale for years. So we'll see how this thing develops. It's exciting. Like I said earlier, I've been pretty critical of these guys, but they've done something. That's all I ask, man. Do something. And they did something. So now we all get to talk and argue and throw out hot takes and debate what that something is. And that's, and what it means. And that's exciting, and that's fun. And that's why we're in all this, So instead of the 30th rehash of sort of the latest exotic UFO theory, it's like, a whole new twist to the UFO conspiracy realm. And that's exciting. So, I'm blown away by this turn of events, and we'll see what happens going forward. It's quite the Christmas present for anyone who's been interested in this stuff for a long time, because it's like, whoa, what is going on, man? And on that note, thank you so much to everybody who listened. Thank you to all the people who submitted questions. Flycatch in the chat room. Let's see if I can hit all the names here. The guy who called in, sorry I didn't get your name. James Leroy Wilson, Jim Vujovich, Chris Hadley, Corey Thornton, Miguel Romero, Red Pill Junkie, T. Erickson, Marty Littlejohn, Sean Knight, William Zabel, Ken Thomas, Kirk Walker, Chris Hobbs, Jim Sapp, Marco Withrow, and D. Schiller. Awesome questions and a fascinating sort of look at what's on the minds of people. And it's crazy because, we posted the call for questions before the article came out at the Times, but a whole bunch of people submitted questions right away. We didn't actually get a bunch of or any questions about the Times thing, so it's kind of funny like that. But we certainly dug into it a lot tonight with Stan. I was fascinated by what he had to say, because, as I said, he's the face and voice of ufology, so he seemed thrilled, and I'm so happy for him, and that's great. So it's you couldn't ask for a better sort of scenario here for the final holiday season of the seasonal, the final holiday special of the seasonal format. Jesus, Benal, can you make it any more confusing? It's the 13th annual special on the 10th season, which is the final season. Whatever. I hope everybody has an awesome holiday season. Thank you so much for listening. Year in review. Oh, it's going to be a wild one. It's going to be a crazy year in review, I'm sure. We got a lot to talk about. With Greg Bishop, I'm still working out the details of the time and all that stuff. It's a weird situation here, because here we have the holiday special on the 19th, wicked early, almost, there's almost 2 weeks still left in the year. So I'm definitely not doing a show next week, because that's December 26th. That's the day after Christmas. That's Boxing Day, folks. You know I don't work on Boxing Day. And I'm actually going to my high school reunion, so that'll be interesting. So 2 weeks from that is what? January 1st. So I don't know if we're necessarily going to do a show on January 1st, but maybe we will. Who knows? But I got to talk to Greg Bishop and figure that out. And I'm not sure. Greg talked about doing a simulcast. I don't know if I want to do a simulcast because this is like his last appearance on the seasonal format. I feel like we should like do something even more epic. So I gotta get in touch with him. So that'll be, you know, at the end of the month. So or at the very, very beginning of 2018. So like, you know, January 1st or 2nd. Not January 1st. I don't want to do it on the 1st. But maybe I will. I don't know. But I'm arguing with myself here when to do it, and I don't even have Greg on the phone. But sometime at the start of the year. So I guess, with all that said, I hope everybody has a very Merry Christmas. I hope they've had an awesome Hanukkah. And have a safe and joyous New Year, because you won't be hearing from me for a couple of weeks. Unless something absolutely bonkers happens, like with UFOs, that I feel the need to do a dramatic, drastic show. But I highly doubt that. So with that in mind, you will probably not be hearing from me until the start of 2018. And with that, have a very Merry Christmas. Hope you've had an awesome Hanukkah. Have a safe New Year. Don't do anything I wouldn't do, or if you do, don't get caught. And until then, thanks for listening. This is Tim Banal, signing off.